to order at 1:40, the 22nd of March. We have present Senator Terrio, Senator Cowdery, Senator Huggins, Senator French is excused, Senator Kukesh is unknown.
On the way.
On the road. Okay, today we were to hear Senate Bill 133, which will not be heard, the Aviation Advisory Board. To be heard today will be Senate Bill 16, relating to the powers and duties of the Department of Transportation, public facilities relating to a transportation plan. There will be a committee substitute 16. Are there any objections to moving working draft version India as a working document?
I'd make a motion to move, adopt the committee substitute for Senate Bill 16. Okay.
And there are no objections between myself and the Godfather, so we're ready to go. Let's see. Doug Letch of Senator Gary Stevens' office will present the bill. Doug? Yeah, Doug, before you get started, let me digress for just a moment. I just share something with you and ask you. The subject is Carl Moses and his service in the Alaska Territorial Guard. For those of you that know Carl, today he was awarded two things. One was an Aleutian campaign certificate for his participation in that, and a medal for his service in the Alaska Territorial Guard. And that was over 60 years ago, I might remind you, and he was 13 years of age when he began that. So if you haven't congratulated Carl, I would encourage you to do that, because it's a big day in his life. With that, please.
Well, it's a tough act to follow, Senator Huggins. For the record, my name is Doug Letch. I'm staff to Senator Gary Stevens, here to talk to you a little bit about Senate Bill 16, and I do have representatives from the Department of Transportation that will walk you through the finer points of the bill. We have brought this bill forward at the request of the department. It's really an effort to update some obsolete language and statute related to the powers of Department of Transportation and public facilities. One of the key points that we got interested in this bill when Senator Stevens worked on it last year with this committee and other members of the Senate is the removal of a burdensome requirement that the department conduct a cost-benefit analysis for all of its projects. And what this requirement has done is placed DOT at a huge disadvantage because it requires every project, and that can include such things as emergency repairs to roads from flood damage or earthquakes, to be subject to a cost-benefit analysis. And more importantly, for constituents in Senator Gary Stevens' area, particularly the Lake and Penn borough, it's been used to halt construction of a bridge over the New Halen River connecting the communities of Ilium and Dalton, as opponents have been able to sue the state for not doing this cost-benefit analysis and bring that into litigation. While this bill will not affect the court case per se, this bill, passage of this bill will help the state avoid future costly litigation that could happen if we don't go through this process. There's other provisions in here that amount to housekeeping measures, and the department will speak to that specifically. Pete Christensen from DOT is here to talk to the bill. Also, a couple other representatives from DOT are here as well, and I'd like to defer any technical questions about the bill to them. And with that, entertain any questions you may have.
Okay. Any questions for Doug?
Is there a dollar value before the study is required to a project? I mean, if they put up a stop sign, does that they have to evaluate that?
Senator Cowdery, through the chair, I'm getting a shaking of the head no on stop sign. I believe it's really the other type of projects that they would put up, whether they have to, if there's a case where a road has been damaged. Say in Kodiak a few years ago, we had some flood damage. Things like that, emergency repairs where I have to come in, this kind of cost-benefit analysis is going to affect that. And really every project out there that's in the STIP and in the system ready to go right now could be subjected to that, and court cases can result as these aren't being done. Or in doing them, you're going to wind up taking money away from where it's really needed in the transportation infrastructure.
Thanks, Doug.
Thanks. And I'd like to turn it over to the department now to answer the more specific questions. Thank you.
Thank you, Doug. Jeff?
Thank
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Jeff Otteson. I'm the Director of Program Development with the Alaska Department of Transportation. And Doug has given you the essence. I mean, basically the one provision in this bill that speaks to cost-benefit language being changed is sort of the heart of the bill. And most of the other sections are essentially housekeeping. Although, I would take you through two sections in particular. Well, section one is housekeeping in nature, but it's just important enough I want to draw your attention to it. The department currently has the authority to issue grants in one of its programs, the Alaska Highway Safety Office. But we currently are receiving federal funds that are then issued out as grant funds in at least two other areas. One is in the Scenic Byway Program, and the second is in the Transit Program. Both those programs are growing. In fact, the Transit Program is growing substantially, and we just feel a little bit kind of at ease or at ease in that we don't have legal authority to be issuing grants and have been doing so for many years. So we draw your attention to that problem. The heart of the bill, as I said a moment ago, is in Section 3. The language in this part of the bill addresses language that was established in statute by Governor Hammond through an administrative order at the time the Department of Transportation was created. And by that process, this language has never actually been voted on by any body of the legislature. Basically, they had to veto it by a vote, but if they didn't veto it, it became law by default. So we're speaking to a piece of statute that's never actually had a vote by the legislature at any time. It had several different requirements, and several of these requirements have been involved in litigation. It spoke to the Alaska Transportation Planning Council, a body that no longer exists. It talks about the department updating a statewide transportation plan applying to all modes on an annual basis. I'm here to tell you that we would have to just about tenfold increase our staff and our budgets to fulfill that requirement. We're lucky to update our transportation plans right now on a 5 or 7 year cycle with the staff that we have. It often takes 3 or 4 years to update a major piece of our transportation planning effort. So the notion that we would update it annually is sort of an ambitious undertaking, very costly and not prudent. So we'd like to change that to periodic. And with respect to the language of considering costs and benefits, at first blush, this seems like a sensible thing to do. Why shouldn't we consider costs and benefits on every project? The reason we find fault with this is a consideration of cost, not at the time that you're actually going to do the project, that it's under design. It's a consideration of costs and benefits 5 or 10 or even 15 years earlier when you're putting it into your long-range transportation plan. Your data is relatively sparse, your sense of what it might become is relatively sparse, and yet you're asked to do a very expensive study. Senator Cowdery a moment ago asked about whether this applies to a stop sign, and I think when the information got transferred from me to Doug, I think maybe there was a disconnect. In fact, it would apply to that. If there's a project in the capital budget, no matter how small, it technically, this language applies. So that's our concern. And as you see in my examples here in my writing, there are many examples of projects where it just creates a nonsensical result.
Do you feel that there's been abuses by some to stop projects by using this to get around?
The one case in particular is the case of a road between Ilium and Dalton, where this has been litigated and it has been used to stop that project. Tragically, two young men died this winter crossing that river on the ice because there is no bridge and road there yet. As you look on the map, you can see the road is really there and leads right to the river from both sides in at least a pioneer form. And so people are using that road and they are crossing that winter ice. And this winter, two young men died. A third man came close to dying but managed to extract himself from the river ice. So there's a real consequence. The people in Dalton want this road. They feel like their lives are being messed with, to be blunt.
But this is not about that particular road, right?
That particular road. We have also received at least one letter from a nonprofit agency asking us questions about general access with respect to this language and wondering whether or not we had done cost-benefit there. But I think our fear is a strict look at cost-benefit in Alaska is a difficult thing. We build airports in rural Alaska. We put lights on those airports, not because there's some cost-effective analysis that's been done, but because there's a basic social good being achieved, the ability for people to be transported in all weather and all light conditions as a requirement of living in rural Alaska. And you could go on and on about bus service, about ferry service. Many things we build in Alaska are not cost-effective as they might be down south. We simply have a large piece of territory with a very small population base.
Jeff, could you walk us through how, what mechanism was used to block the non-Dalton? It was a bridge you talked about, right? The
yes, I'm sorry, what mechanism?
How, could you just walk us through how regulation was used to block the non-Dalton?
Well, the lawsuit had several different causes of action, but one of those causes of action was that the department had not conducted a cost-benefit study at the time it selected the project. The project was put in the STIP and begun in about 1995. It was well underway, had finished an environmental document, and in 2002 is when the litigation was filed. Just prior to that, or sort of during that time period, we updated the Southwest Alaska Transportation Plan, and we specifically chose not to consider that project because it was already in the pipeline. It was already an action that was underway, and we didn't feel it was prudent to be spending money analyzing projects that we'd already, the department had already decided to pursue, and quite frankly, the legislature had agreed with us and given us legislative authority to build it. So the issue became, I forget the term now, but basically not looking at projects were underway was one of the issues of litigation. Whether or not we did cost-benefit analysis was an issue of consideration. The judge had basically agreed with the department that you can go ahead once a project's begun and continue it, but her ruling was, you can't show me where you truly considered cost and benefits in 1995. So she put the preliminary injunction as requested by the other side on the project, told us to stand down, and not to come back until you had updated the plan. We spent $60,000 in consultant cost, another $20,000 to $30,000 in staff cost to update the plan, and then went back to the court and the judge just in January of this year and got that injunction overruled or really dismissed.
Who was it, local interest that brought this suit or this injunction, or was it?
It's an individual who owns a recreational property up lake from the bridge, about 12 or 14 miles, who lives in Anchorage. The communities there are very supportive of this project, non-Dalton and Illiamna. The source of the lawsuit, and this, there's actually been several different legal challenges. There's also been a legal challenge filed in federal court that was recently dismissed, and I understand just this week was now been appealed to the Ninth Circuit, all by the same individual. But so it's a non-local person who believes that who wants to see a wild Alaska, who wants to enjoy a river without a bridge across it.
Was this considered a public interest lawsuit? Who paid the bills?
Well, there's two names on the lawsuit. It's Trout Unlimited and Robert Gillum. And, you know, I believe it's Robert Gillum that has the financing for this, but I don't know that. I couldn't say that for certain.
That's on their, the property's on 6 Mile Lake. Is that what we're talking
about? Correct. You can see that on our map here. There's a map in the back of my package, and quite a ways up lake there in the northeast direction on the same side of the lake as non-Dalton is, I believe, a piece of land known as Keys Point that was sold as a subdivision site several years ago, and now there is what is described as a cabin on the property, although some would say at 14,000 square feet it's bigger than a cabin.
What are the elements of a cost-benefit analysis?
Well, the language of the statute is consider costs and benefits. We actually use a technique that's not as technically demanding as cost-benefit, what we call a cost-effectiveness analysis. And what you essentially do is you add up the cost, you subtract any transportation savings that you can identify, and we identified a lot of savings in the area of freight transportation, fuel, building materials, that sort of thing, and then divided that by the future population to come up with a cost per person served, essentially. At This project, when we did that analysis last summer, had the second highest ratio, the second best ratio in all of Southwest Alaska. The best project being the Williamsport to Pyle Bay project, which is a project that we've already done work on and are moving forward on with additional funding at this time. So this really ended up being the number two in a list of about 15 or 20 projects that we might have looked at in all of Southwest Alaska. Now, if you were to compare that analysis to a project in Anchorage, it won't stack up. You simply, there aren't enough people there.
Right. Yeah, as I recall, just, I'm going to be flying down there this weekend, I hope, checking on Mr. Caribou. But the trail that you have on the map is essentially a snow machine trail anyway, whether improved or unimproved, right?
Well, you see the three colors there?
Right.
We've characterized them up in the top. Part of the green is a true road. The blue line is a gravel road. And I think the red line is essentially what you would now call an ATV trail.
Well, you know, Jeff, to be honest with you, my experience is that you need a little structure, not too much, but you got to have enough to have accountability, because what happens in the long run, all too often, is when you take out structure, when you're gone and Nona is gone, suddenly we can become very freewheeling, if you follow my logic.
Mm-hmm.
And it's easy for all of us to be able to take out structure. And but in the same token, what we don't need to do is to have language that causes us not to be able to do business, because people that file injunctions or get injunctions obviously are our worst enemy in a lot of cases, in this case, as an example. What's short of a cost-benefit analysis? There must be other techniques.
Well, our STIP project selection process that we use today has 14 questions that speak to several different aspects. The project gets scored.
That with you? You have an example?
I didn't bring that, but I can certainly provide it to you very quickly.
Yeah, that would be beneficial. I'm sympathetic to what we're talking about here, but in the same token, I'm hesitant to just start taking structure out that is a safeguard factor for all of us, if nothing else, is a reminder of how to do business.
I think the one thing that maybe will give you more comfort is that we have a whole rule book of federal rules we also must comply with. Okay. If you took the entire state statute away, expunge it from the record book, we would still have to follow all Title 23 and all CFR 23, which is a very significant planning process for transportation.
Could you talk us through the business of grants and awards?
Absolutely. The one area where the department currently has the ability to issue grants is in our Highway Safety Office. This is an office that receives money from the National Highway Transportation Safety Administration. It's a small branch of USDOT. They receive approximately $7 million a year, and their focus is on the behavior side of highway safety. The seatbelt campaigns you see on the TV, the enforcement initiatives by Alaska State Troopers and local police, those are all grant programs that they help pay for. Basically, it's money we get to address what I call the behavioral side of safety. And they have authority under the current statute to issue those grants. The areas where we don't have authority, the Federal Transit Program has several different programs. Grants for the disabled and the elderly, for vans, and so nonprofit groups, senior centers, local governments, all receive or potentially can receive money from these programs, basically to buy vans. That's the most common thing we grant money for. We also grant money to groups like in MATSU, the mascot program, to help them organize and coordinate their transportation. So we feel that we are doing these grants and have been, and because we receive, right now the federal money is growing and growing substantially. And we just felt that if we're going to open up the statute, let's fix this disconnect, because we receive this money, we're expected to issue grants, And in fact, we get authority through the capital budget process to do it, but our statute has kind of got a disconnect. Our statute doesn't say that we have that authority. The same is true of the scenic byways program.
But the provision is for the appropriation by the state legislature, right?
Right. And I think that was the legislative drafter wanted that language added so that we just couldn't grant anything we happen to have in our back room. So you have to give us authority through the budget process to issue grants. And at the same token, this says that we have that authority. And as you know, a grant is somewhat different than a contract. It's not subject to the procurement code. It's a different animal, if you would, under law.
Let's take the, was it $200,000, John, that was going to the paving?
Yeah.
Could you talk us through how you did that?
Last year, it went to UAF.
And we're allowed to give money to other governmental organizations as a government-to-government transfer. The state procurement code authorizes that as a transfer that does not require procurement.
But it was a slow process of almost a year of getting it done.
Yeah, I think last year the federal money was a slow process. The federal money dribbled out in 5 installments last year.
So that was federal money that you...
That was a federal process problem. The federal, they were working through the reauthorization of T21, and they kept extending the process. So instead of getting our money all at once at the front of the year, which we could then use, we got it in 5 installments, the last installment being in August, the 10th month of the federal fiscal year.
UAA now has that money, or UAF? Or
they should, yeah. They now have the ability to bill us as they spend it. They bill us and we reimburse them.
So that system, but that was the federal piece.
Right. That's... But from a standpoint, that's not technically a grant. That's technically a transfer between really two agencies of state government.
So, but legally, what do we call it?
I'm talking about being able to issue money to organizations like the Catholic Senior Services here in Juneau and groups like that, nonprofits around the state.
Non-governmental entities.
Non-governmental entities. And in case of highway safety, they issue groups to like MAD, NCAD. These are nonprofits also.
Right.
But this money that I think that I'm talking about was a grant out of discretionary funds for me to the up there, but it went through DOT. It was some of capital money.
Yeah, and you may be right, Senator. I have not been dealing with that. I can find out for you on that.
I think
we will be discussing this in later sessions. If you would, you know, in our follow-on to this, we're not going to pass this
right
out today. So
we can certainly find out for you.
Yeah. So, I mean, just a case in point of how we, because it, I
we
wasn't
to the test lab.
I recall at a meeting here a few weeks ago, we talked about that. But the essence here is the grants to the non-governmental entities that we currently feel like we are lacking full legal authority.
Is university considered a government entity?
The university?
Yes.
Yes. And in fact, we do issue what are called RSAs with them, which is really an agreement between government entities. There's a specific exemption in the state procurement code for government-to-government transfer.
Jeff, if you go to page 3, line 19. In line 19, goes from what was characterized as annually to periodically. Periodically is in the eye of the beholder. In the question over time, you and I know that the rationale how we're changing from annually to periodically potentially, but when you and I and Nona and John Cadre are gone, maybe we lose the intent of what we're doing, and suddenly periodically can be, once again, go back to whosever imagination we want to use. How do we create some congruent thought process for me and you to understand what periodically means?
I think the check and balance here is there's constantly an oversight of programs in office. Like just in the past year, the governor's office and the legislature has asked us to look at fleet management, our fleet, ways to save money. And managers in this system are constantly looking at that. I remember when natural gas was really considered to be the up-and-coming alternative fuel, the department actually hosted a natural gas conference in Anchorage trying to kind of jumpstart the use of natural gas vehicles. We funded a program at the municipality of Anchorage to do just that. So there was, without this language, we were trying to make it happen because it looked like it was both a cost savings and it had other social benefits. Now what's happened is natural gas, for technical reasons, has fallen out of favor, at least as a direct fuel. It may be a source of hydrogen in the future. But the hybrids and hydrogen vehicles seems to be where the marketplace is heading. And so I think this is one of these duties that isn't funded right now. No one's giving us money to do this periodic or this annual study. My guess is if you ask me, are we doing this annually, I'd have to say no. But we don't like being in a position of having a duty that says do something every year. We aren't really being funded for it, and realistically, we aren't in position to do it.
But in the same token, there's some magic recurring date that, from the department's perspective, that should emerge, all right? Whether it's 24 months, 36
like
months?
Every 3 years, every 5 years, a little bit easier to absorb that in your budget because you can kind of...
No, I understand. We understand the rationale. What I want, though, is so that we have the same expectation and periodically is as open-ended as you can make it.
True it is.
So when we come back, I would ask us to figure out what that number is.
Right.
And let's discuss that. Because I think in the same thing...
Section
3? Let's not... Yeah, it's the same critter.
It uses periodic. Well, we propose periodic in the new section 15, page 4, line 23.
I'm sorry, where are you?
Page 4, yeah. Line 23. It's a new section 15
right.
There.
Correct, yeah, same thing.
Let me just speak to you why I'm recommending this language. Transportation finance is undergoing a sea change, rapid sea change. States around the country are recognizing that the fuel tax on gallons is about to no longer serve us well.
Right.
A lot of things happening, but hybrid cars, hydrogen cars are all part of that mix and why. The state of Texas has decided to toll the entire interstate and highway and freeway system because they recognize that gas taxes aren't cutting it. So our only idea here is we can see these changes occurring. We should at least have the duty to periodically study it. And right now, there's no actual duty on the department to do that.
Yeah, but we get back to the same thing about some number that we all can see the same thing when we read it.
And I think
whatever that might be,
we'd be happy to find that.
I don't have to answer that right now, but just come back with us something that's a little more concrete than periodical. Let's go back to on page 3, line 27. Business of inventory facilities.
Right.
Could you talk us through what we're doing there?
Well, this is kind of an awkward sentence, but if you look at the full length of that, it's for municipalities with populations of less than 12,000 and for unincorporated communities. This is a duty that really the entire funding for this has essentially lapsed. We're no longer receiving funding. We're not staffed for it. We're not performing this duty. It dates back to a time in the 70s when the department was in charge of building local schools for small communities, had a large staff of architects and building managers, and were overseeing those programs. And school districts now oversee those programs directly. We're no longer in their kitchen. And so if we're no longer involved in the program, then we really have no need to be there, to be out there asking to do their inventory work and to be managing them. This really is now the province of those local governments and local school districts.
So line 27 on page 3 through 1 through 4 on page 4 is only talking about schools.
It's talking about buildings in general, public facilities in general, but the majority of things that we were building at the time this language was created was in the school program.
What are the other items that would be here?
I'm trying to think of what other buildings we might have built for local governments. This is sort of predates my time. I only know about it by sort of, you know, the history of talking to other staff over the years. But we had a very large school program at that time in rural Alaska.
But if we went to Nome or Kotzebue, as an example, I don't know how many people Nome has, probably not more than 12,000.
Those would be less than 12,000.
Right. What sort of things would we find in Nome?
Well, you would find all kinds of public buildings. I mean, city halls and public workshops and all that. But I think this would only be buildings that we actually had a role in.
Nome has control of all those now.
They have control of all those.
Any buildings in Nome?
We have no. We don't. I mean, we own buildings on state transportation assets. We would own the building at the airport that houses the fire rescue buildings. We, in some airports, we own the terminal. Other airports, we do not. Depends upon the situation.
But this would take away your requirement to of maintaining accountability for them.
Yeah, but what I'm trying to suggest is we have not been funded or staffed to do this now for well over a decade. This is now a latent duty, a duty that's on the books but isn't being exercised.
No, I understand. But somebody's got to do it. I mean, if we aren't going to do it, then Nome's got to do it. And if Nome's not going to do it, we have to do it. Is that correct? I mean, we just can't turn our back on it.
Well, if...
Help me out. I'm sorry.
I think, in fact, the state has turned its back on it. And some years ago when we stopped funding that duty. And now local governments, if they seek funding through the state, they will advocate to you directly for those. But they don't come to us and advocate and ask us to come to you. We're out of that circle of communication.
Gukesh, does any of this make sense to you in some of the rural communities?
The only thing I'm familiar with is the requirement for schools to maintain a maintenance program, but I'm really not following.
And I think that comes now from the Department of Education, I believe.
Right. Yeah. Schools are clear-cut. I mean, that's a pretty clear-cut thing.
And I should be clear. This would not apply to any state-owned building that happens to be situated in a small community. This is about buildings the state does not own.
Time. Who owns the buildings that we're talking about here that we're trying to get rid of?
These are buildings owned by the local governments or the local school districts, the REAs and most places.
But you know what I don't want to do is for us to have a change that 3 years from now, you know, somebody, a building burns down and we're all pointing to one another about who owned the building. In the insurance, and three people burned up in it, sort of thing. If you follow my logic,
yeah, absolutely. And I just having watched our building program. I mean, it was small when I arrived at the department in the mid '80s, and it went from three or four people down to an absolute to zero, at least here in this city, that are doing these kinds of things, issuing kinds of standards. It's a part of our business that we have slowly gotten out of. And I think that's as the REAs were developed and established and they started being funded directly by the Department of Education. They became managers of their own kingdom.
This is where Fish and Game has a presence.
Yeah, and those are still state buildings and we still have a role to play there and we still work with them, although most agencies are now doing their own maintenance, with a few exceptions, like the state office building is maintained, I believe, by the department. But a lot of the military and veterans affairs have their own maintenance programs. So does Fish and Game, DNR as well.
Okay. So,
but this language is really not about them. This is about these
DOT
being involved with local governments below 12,000.
Okay. Okay, other questions for Mr. Otteson? Other things you want to bring to our attention, Jeff?
Just one word you mentioned about Section 4. Section 4 is essentially the process by which the department develops the list of projects that are to be constructed in the near term. Words that come to mind would be STIP and the AIP for the highway and aviation program. And then, of course, those documents get transferred into capital budget request.
Which line are you talking about?
This is really all Section 4 on page 5. And we're just trying to clean this up so that the process is basically consistent with the practice that's now followed by the OMB and the legislative process that we interact with. For example, now the capital budget now is done annually. It's not done on a two-year basis, but the statute speaks to a two-year submittal.
And on line 26, we're talking about following 2 years, including recommended project priority fund.
The language is deleted, right?
This is, yeah, on line 26, this is all language being deleted. Okay. But we're really just trying to make statute conform to current practice. It's the best way to put this.
Senator Kukesh, I would encourage you, if you have any questions on this, because potentially some of the rural communities and the divide could occur there, and I want to make sure that we don't do anything innocently by intent here that has an impact that's unforeseen.
I appreciate your encouragement, but if I had a concern, I'd bring it up. I'm not that bashful.
Good. I appreciate your paying attention. Thank you very much.
I would like to draw one more point, and it goes to rural communities especially. Because of the lawsuit, because of the ruling of the judge in the lawsuit, we've had to modify the STIP nomination process by which local governments nominate projects. We now, by that ruling, have to ask them to do that cost-benefit study ahead of getting any funding. They now have to pay for a cost-benefit analysis at the time they submit projects. And I know communities are complaining about this. I would understand that. And what I'm trying to say is that's one of the consequences of this lawsuit and this court interpretation. And so unless we can find a way to change the law, that consequence will have to be, we'll have to just stand firm on, because we feel that that's one of the requirements that the court drove home to us. You have to do that step.
Any other questions for Mr. Otteson? Thanks, Jeff. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Is anyone else in the room here that has information or questions? Mr. Jeff Parker? Is Mr. Parker online?
Yes, I'm online. Thank you.
Jeff, would you put your name and your affiliation on the record, and we're prepared for your testimony.
Thank you. My name is Jeff Parker. I'm an attorney in Anchorage, and I represented Trout Unlimited and Bob Yellum in the court case that has been referred to previously in this hearing. I proceed?
Yes, please.
Okay, thank you. First of all, I was pleased to hear that the committee is going to hold the bill for a little bit. And I heard some hesitancy about basically removing structure. I believe it was from the chair of the committee. Well, I would be pleased. I'm here basically to try and answer any questions about the court case. But the threshold is to work with the committee and its staff to try and resolve the issue about what is the appropriate statutory language to address costs and benefits. I think there are some solutions that we can have here. And again, I would be pleased to work with the committee or its staff to suggest what those solutions are. I think one thing that's important to understand at the beginning is that cost benefit, the requirement that costs and benefits be considered, are only transportation or new facilities, in this case new transportation facilities. It was not correct when departmental staff said that the requirement of cost and benefits be considered applied to all projects. Most projects that are in the STIP are actually improvements to existing facilities. They're repaving, reconstruction, that sort of thing. There, only costs are, the statute requires only the costs be considered. With respect to new facilities, however, it requires the costs and benefits be considered. The question came up, for example, does the stop sign qualify? That's a place where the statute is ambiguous and could be improved. I don't think anyone would argue that a stop sign ought to require a cost-benefit analysis. So there's room for improving this statute. The size of the project at issue, I believe one of the senators also mentioned, may have been Senator Cowdery, I don't recognize all the voices unless people identify themselves, and I apologize. But I believe it was Senator Cowdery who asked, does this requirement apply regardless of the size, the dollar sign, attached to a project? That's another avenue of a way in which the statute could be improved. I don't think anyone would object to a provision, and I think most would support a provision, that establishes some floor level below which the requirements of cost and benefits be considered, not applied. I think you can also improve the statute by defining what facility means, the word facility in the statute. And that goes hand in hand with this issue, for example, about the stop sign. And you can improve the statute by defining what periodically means. Those are ways that I would be pleased to work with the committee to try and clarify and fix this statute to overcome what I hope to create some consensus between the department and the public purposes that are served by having cost benefit or some consideration of costs and benefits. Now, one more thing about this statute. I don't think it is fair to call it obsolete. I believe everyone on the committee would think that consideration of costs and benefits is common sense. It's really one of the fundamental pieces of information that the department, the public, the governor, and the legislature institutionally rely upon in order to make certain that good projects rise to the top and bad ones don't. That's the reason, that is the good reason, I would hope, that I believe it was the chair, Senator Hogan, said that he was hesitant to remove structure. The structure here is important, and its purposes are important, and we should preserve those, but we should try and address problems that occur on the fringes, such as some of those I've talked about. What is the meaning of facility? That sort of thing. Now, if there are any questions about the court case in particular, I'd be pleased to answer them up right there.
Questions for Mr. Parker? Mr. Parker, you mentioned, this is Senator Huggins, you mentioned one of your clients, Trout Unlimited. Beyond waterways and pollution of waterways based on crossing and whatever, could you give us any other concerns that your client might have?
Yes. Trout Unlimited is generally involved in a, I assume you want, you're asking me what are their types of concerns and their interests?
Correct.
Correct.
Okay.
Hello, can you hear me?
Yes, correct.
Oh, okay, thanks. Trout Unlimited is the nation's largest cold water fisheries conservation organization. And it has probably about 700 members here in Alaska. It is generally involved in a variety of land use, habitat, fishery management issues. And those include transportation projects because they affect fisheries and fish habitat in a variety of ways. In this case, I think the greatest concern is about what this road and bridge project does with in several different arenas. One is, what does it do in terms of increasing levels of use on an extremely high quality fishery? The other is that historically the Philly on the Dalton Road and Bridge project has been justified in connection with the Pebble Beach mine. And that's an issue that is of concern to a whole wide variety of fishery interests, commercial, subsistence, recreational. Does that help?
Yes. Let me make sure I have it correct, that you're concerned about the mining interest?
That's historically part of this project, yes.
Okay, thank you. Other questions for Mr. Parker? Okay, thank you, Mr. Parker.
Sure. And if there is anyone you would like me to work with on committee staff to try and suggest or work with the department, Mr. Otteson, I'd be pleased to do so, to try and come up with language that basically preserves the value of cost, of considering costs and benefits for new projects. That's what's at issue. But make it so that it doesn't become a cumbersome, unnecessary hurdle that needs to be surmounted for a whole host of other projects that I don't think have ever been applied to, frankly, such as stop signs. I'd be pleased to work with the appropriate staff, if you can point me in that direction.
Yeah, Mr. Parker, Debbie is the staff person responsible for this. You can contact her.
Debbie.
And then we can work in conjunction with DOT.
Okay. I appreciate it. Thank you.
Okay. Other comments or questions on this bill? Okay. We will hold this over. Jeff, what we talked about previously in respect to the structure, this is one of those that obviously has existed for a long time, so I consider it not time sensitive. It needs to be fixed, but we just need to make sure we can live with whatever the fixes are and generationally that it works for us when you and I and Nona are gone. Okay, good. We're adjourned.